like to start this session. This is session 225. If Mormon women have had the priesthood since 1843, why aren't they using it? I'd like to mention that the session that was scheduled for this room, Crisis on Campus, session 223, the impact of BYU's current political climate on students, was moved to later today at 215 in the granary. Maybe that's symbolic, I don't know. We hope you're here, though, to hear our session, and you'll also attend the BYU session later. Nearly 10 years ago, in 1984, Linda Newell and Margaret Toscano read two groundbreaking papers on Mormon women and priesthood at the Sunstone Symposium. A short time after that, Mike Quinn responded to Linda Newell's paper, and their two pieces were published in Sunstone. Margaret Toscano's paper was also published in Sunstone. Linda Newell's paper was The Historical Relationship of Mormon Women and Priesthood. And Margaret Toscano's paper was The Missing Rib, The Forgotten Role of Queens and Priestesses. At that time, as an editor at BYU, I sat in the audience and listened to Margaret and Linda and said to myself, every Mormon woman needs to hear these papers. I made a mental note to try to think about a way to make these papers more available. My book was intended to make groundbreaking feminist theology readily available to Mormon women and to reprint papers that I felt needed a wider audience, such as these two, along with Mike Quinn's response to Linda's paper. This panel today ties together nearly 10 years of discussion, disagreement, and work on women and priesthood. Also, these panelists, including myself, have all at one time or another been chastised, reprimanded, or threatened by church leaders for their research and writing. As you can see, though, this hasn't stopped any of us from being here today. We'll start first with Linda Newell. She is also the co-author of Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith, and former co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. We'll go next to D. Michael Quinn, who is the editor of The New Mormon History. And we'll go after that to Margaret Merrill Toscano, co-author of Strangers in Paradox, Explorations in Mormon Theology. And last, we'll hear from me, Maxine Hanks, editor of Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. Then we'll entertain questions from the audience.
Thank you, Maxine, for putting this session together and for the introduction. Basically, what we're doing here today is to give you the background of how we came to write the essays that are in Maxine's edited works, Mormon Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, and what we intended by those essays when they were originally written, conceived, and published, perhaps what we didn't intend, and then talk about a little bit about the issue that addresses the name of this session. How I came to write this essay goes way back. My essay is entitled The Historical Relationship of Mormon Women and the Priesthood. I began the research on the biography that I co-authored with Feline Avery in January of 1975. Not too far into this research, and you have to understand that that went on for 9 years, I began going through the Relief Society minutes, the original Relief Society minutes. They had not been open to researchers for very long at all. In fact, I think I was one of the first two or three people to read through those. And I just was astounded at what I was reading in these minutes of the first Relief Society, the kinds of things that women were doing. They were giving blessings to each other. Joseph Smith, when someone complained to him about what was going on in the Relief Society, he came to the next meeting and told the women that there was no more harm in a woman giving a blessing than wetting the face with water, and that if the blessing was successful, then there should be no one who would question that. And it really hit me that these women were doing things just so naturally, and it was so naturally approved by the leadership of the church that was just unheard of in 1975 in the church. And I became curious about other blessings, other spiritual gifts of women, and I began making a separate file on that I had entitled Gifts of the Spirit. And that file eventually became a large article that was published later on in this book, Sisters in Spirit, by the University of Illinois Press. They've just put it out in paperback, too. And that article was called... it's been a long time here. A Gift Given. No, wait, that was another one. Gifts of the Spirit, Women Share. All right, let me get my act together here. And all of the other articles that I have written about spiritual gifts of women and women in the priesthood and so forth have been a spin-off from the research from that original article. Now, I think it would be interesting for you to know how this other book came about, because I think it has served as a basic text since its publication in 1985 for much of what is going on in women's studies, in Mormon women's studies, having to do with a historical context at all. There was a group of women, and they included Maureen Beecher and Levina Fielding Anderson. Levina was then with the Ensign, Maureen was with the Church History Department. Jill Mulvey-Durr, who was working with Maureen on Eliza's poetry, and Eliza Snow's poetry, and many other projects. Both of them were publishing all kinds of things in Mormon women's history. Carol Cornwall Madsen had just come to work for the historical department of the church, too. Linda Wilcox was doing research on various things, particularly Mother in Heaven. Melody Mensch Charles was also working for the church as a researcher, and her expertise is in biblical studies and Hebrew and so forth. And we would get together once a week for lunch. And we met in the Lion House, and then for lunch on Wednesdays, the Wednesday lunch bunch. And we were joined by a number of other people: Sharon Swenson, Greta Peterson, Mary Beth Raines, Mary Ann McMurray, and a number of other women, people from Boston who would come in and out of town. And one day when we were sitting around talking about our various research, I said, we were talking about the impact that women's studies would eventually have on the church. And I looked around the table at these women, and the thought occurred to me, if there was some way that we could take this body of information that we knew and get the information to the brethren in a non-threatening way, that we could perhaps stave off a polarization that we really saw coming later on over women's issues in the church. And we talked about various ways of doing that and realized that women had no voice except only indirectly, and that ours was so indirect that there was just no possible way that we could do this. We would be seen as trying to counsel the brethren, which is a no-no. We might be seen as threatening as a group of women. We might be, if we did this one at a time in some way, we felt like it was a disadvantage to be overwhelmed by the whole male hierarchy, or even as individuals. And so it was Jill who said, well, let's write a book. And so Levina and Maureen decided that that they would edit it together. And so that's where Sisters in Spirit came from. Linda Wilcox's essay, groundbreaking essay on Mother in Heaven, with all the speculation and so forth that has gone on before that, this is the solid base for that, for much of what has gone on beyond that. I think one of the things that I was really pleased with was that Jolene Rockwood, who had not been part of this group, but Maureen and, or maybe it was Levina, knew about her. She has a master's degree from Harvard Divinity School, Eve, and her essay, Perceptions of Eve, was the first in this book. And it was the most wonderfully liberating thing that I had read. It's still my favorite of all the essays in this book, and I love them all. Marianne McMurray is a poet, and she expressed in the two poems that appeared in this book the feelings of many of us in some of the experiences that we had together during this time that were bonding for us as a group. And Carol Cornwald Madsen's essay on women in the temple was beautifully and sensitively written in a non-threatening way. We all wanted to be non-threatening in the way that we presented our material. It was close to our hearts and close to our testimonies and to our basis in the church. We didn't want to see the material polarized, and we didn't want to see it become divisive. Unfortunately, I think it has, and I'm sorry for that. Not sorry for anything that any of us did. I'm just sorry for the situation that has developed over the last few years. As I mentioned before, Sisters in Spirit has become a basic text for many who are writing in Mormon women's studies. Another outgrowth of this project, and Maxine, I'm going to have to correct you. Is that all right? Mike Quinn originally responded to an article that was published in Sunstone magazine in the, and was given in the 1980 Sunstone Symposium that I gave called A Gift Given, A Gift Taken. And that, I think, and he will go into that in more detail, I think, was the beginning of his writing on women and the priesthood. And it was a response to that article rather than the one I gave 4 years ago, 4 years later in 1984 that was published in Dialogue. And that's the one that that Maxine has reprinted in this book. But and that was the historical relationship of Mormon women and the priesthood. And that is also in Dialogue in 1985. I'm not going to go through here. In fact, I'm not going to take much time at all because we want to leave time for you to have questions and for us to answer them or deal with them. But basically, what I found in all of this is that the gifts of the Spirit that women practiced openly were non-gendered in the beginnings of Mormondom, that women and men shared in them equally, that they were accepted equally. And my hope in beginning to write about this clear back in the 70s was that through seeing the historical context and seeing how beautifully these blessings that are now just seen as only priesthood prerogatives, how beautifully they were integrated into the community as a whole and how acceptant they were, that my hope was that women would again be given the privileges that they had in the early church. I'm going to just read the end of my essay and as a closing here because I think it capsulizes how I feel about this issue. A rediscovery of the history of Mormon women's spiritual gifts has awakened interest in the idea of mothers and fathers jointly anointing and blessing their own children, as presidents of the church did and their wives did in the last century. Of husbands receiving, like Wilfred Woodruff, blessings from their wives. Of mothers standing in the circles when their babies are blessed. Of women blessing each other or their children, giving them a mother's blessing, as well as them being able to have a father's blessing, as Lucy Mack Smith often did, and many other Mormon women. In times of need, of women as well as men jointly exercising spiritual gifts on behalf of each other. A broader, more inclusive understanding of priesthood could strengthen marital and family ties and once again allow unmarried women to share more fully in the gifts of the Spirit, which were once common in the household of faith. This could mean a reexamination of the LDS policy of ordaining women to the priesthood, or it could simply mean making changes in the general handbook of instructions, which has stripped women of these opportunities through the accumulation of over 100 years of policy development. But until then, Susie Young Gates' statement still rings clear. The privileges and powers outlined by the prophet Joseph Smith have never been granted to women in full, even yet. Thank you.
I'd like to begin with an observation on this gathering, which is giving credit where credit is due. I've, over the years, attended a number of professional meetings in which there have been sessions on women's issues, women's history at professional organizations, whether it's the American Historical Association or Western Historical Association, or a number of other primarily historically oriented associations. And over the years, it always bothered me that in the women's sessions I attended, the attendance of women counted for 90 to 95% of those in attendance. And as I was looking across the room, two things struck me. One, this is a very large group in attendance. Two, my guess, in just as a kind of a eye view, is that about a third of the people in attendance here are males, which is a complete, in terms of a number of years of experience in professional meetings, this is a complete departure from the national trend of male interest in women's history and women's issues, even though it's within the academic community. So we're not talking about people off the street who might not be interested in academics. Generally, it's a trend that I've noticed throughout the academic field. And so I think that this is an important comment to make about our community, because those of us who are male need to be reminded sometimes, but I don't think that reminder is necessary for any of those here, that women's issues are our issues as well. So I wanted to make that comment to give praise where praise is due. I started this journey, as with a number of them I've made in Mormon history and in my Mormon path generally, sort of unintentionally. The 1980 opportunity that I had was given to me by Peggy Fletcher at the time, Peggy Fletcher Stack now, who asked me to respond to Linda Newell's paper at a Sunstone Symposium. And my initial response was, I don't think a male ought to be responding to this paper the way you've defined it. I think it'd be more appropriate for a woman to respond than for me to give a male's perspective. But Peggy was persuasive and also encouraged me by saying that there would be also a woman's perspective as a response in addition to mine, so that mine would not simply be the only response. And it was about a page and a half, something like that, when it was published in Sunstone. Had no footnotes, which is kind of a first for me, I guess. And yet, it drew on things that I had come across in my several years of research. I had the research technique that, even though I had very clear interests of things that I expected to write on, when I took notes on anything that I thought might be possibly interesting to me in Mormon history. And so I kept coming across these references to women performing ordinances, many times for men, healing ordinances, and I came across references in notes I'd taken to patriarchal blessings of women where they were told by the patriarchs, very often the presiding patriarch of the church, that they would receive the priesthood when they entered the temple to receive the endowment. And these were new issues to me, but I thought, that's interesting, and I would take notes, and I would go on to my other more pressing interests in terms of immediate publishing goals. But my note-taking habit was that anything that was a kind of item, I would take notes on extensively. And so I drew on those for giving that response. And again, as I said, it was unfootnoted, but it did draw on the perspective that I gained. Then when Maxine was preparing her collection of essays, she asked me, when I was living in New Orleans, if I would like to have mine included. And my initial response, again, was, oh, really? It's only a page. It's only a page and a half. Why would you want, it's not that significant, why would you want to have that included in, you know, this major collection? But she was persistent, and I said, well, okay, I'll revise it, but I imagine it'll only be about 5 or 6 pages long by the time we're done. Well, as I start, this time it was going to be footnoted, and I should have known that that was a danger sign to begin with. But that's how I got into it. That's how it came to be the article. And every time I'd send Maxine a draft, Maxine would say, gee, this is really good, Mike, but you have kind of ignored this issue, or have you thought about that issue? And I was continually prodded to good work by Maxine in the process of this, and it grew literally from my first submission. I think it was about 5-6 pages, under 10, I believe, when I sent it to Maxine the very first time. And it grew from that, and grew not only in the length of it, but also it grew in the development of what issues I saw involved. And I'd like to turn to those very briefly. Beginning, as I did not in the essay, but beginning with Brigham Young's comment to a public congregation in the Salt Lake Tabernacle in 1874. He said, "That man who honors his priesthood shall be exalted in the world to come. And that woman who honors her priesthood shall be exalted in the kingdom of heaven." And that's got to be a double take kind of quote for most Mormons today. What did he mean when he said, "That woman who honors her priesthood shall be exalted"? And to understand that, you have to leapfrog back to Joseph Smith's statements to the Relief Society during its early formation, that he was going to make of the Relief Society a kingdom of priests, that he was going to give to the women, or actually said the Lord would give to the women, the keys, whereby they may ask and receive and know whether a communication is from God or not from God. And this referred to the true order of prayer, which was soon given to men. At this point, men had not even received the endowment. A couple of months later, men received those ordinances. And not for about a year and a half after that did women. But the remarks of Joseph Smith set the pattern. for what Brigham Young later publicly stated. And in the intervening period of time, about a 30-year period, I found a number of references, primarily by those who had personally been endowed by Joseph Smith in Nauvoo before the construction of the temple, who had received instruction from him about what the meaning of the endowment and what these ordinances represented. And repeatedly in their diaries, and for those who were patriarchs from that group and patriarchal blessings they gave, they referred to the women who received the endowment as having priesthood. Now, sometime, I guess it was last April, Boyd Packer, in a kind of response to the general position of the essay, said that there are some who regard the priesthood as some kind of airy thing that you can pick up like a cold, essentially. That's not the meaning of what was expressed in the various statements of Joseph Smith and those he endowed or in the patriarchal blessings. The priesthood is not just conferred by simply walking into the temple. It's not even conferred by the fact that a person enters the temple and begins the endowment. Anyone who has received the endowment knows that priesthood and priesthood keys are conferred in very specific stages. First the Aaronic, and then the Melchizedek. And I'm not explaining anything that isn't in print. It has, in fact, publicly, the general authorities sometimes offered the suggestion that the priesthood endowment be divided, so that the Aaronic be given as a priesthood endowment for those who were not ready to receive the keys of the Melchizedek priesthood. And this is how women receive priesthood. They receive it through the conferral of those keys of the priesthood in the course of the endowment, which happens in very specific stages and a very specific conferral. It is conferred in an ordinance. It is conferred very specifically. But what does all this mean? And that goes to the question of the panel. And I must say that I, in writing the article, I did not write the article to reform the church, to change church policy. I wrote the article for one primary purpose, because I feel, and I think there's good reason for that feeling, that there has been a great loss in self-awareness of women of their own strengths, their own gifts in Mormonism. And correspondingly, there has a strength and a denigration of women and women's roles by males. And that I don't know that males can be regarded as misogynist in this respect any more than females can be regarded as committing kind of a suicide of their self-esteem. This has just been a process that has occurred in the past 50 to 75 years in Mormonism. And the article I wrote primarily was to show how women had a status as priests, were regarded as priestesses, particularly those who were given the right, as they continue to have the right, to confer priesthood authority and keys on other women through the endowment, and that women and men jointly regarded women as having power in the 19th century. And that was a major emphasis of what I intended when I wrote the article, that women today and men today might understand that nothing needs to change in church policy for a woman to have an increased sense of the power that is hers. First of all, simply by being a child of God, but second of all, by the priesthood conferral that occurs within the endowment. I did indicate that the implications are that because repeatedly in the 19th century the males who had been instructed by Joseph Smith said that women received priesthood when they received the endowment and they received the Melchizedek priesthood, and that those who had received the second anointing had received the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood. In church doctrine, anyone who has the Melchizedek priesthood can perform healing ordinances, can administer the sacrament, can confer the gift of the Holy Ghost, can confirm membership, can baptize. By definition, if you have the Melchizedek priesthood, you can do all those things. You don't need to have a particular office if you have the Melchizedek priesthood. And so, because of the theology of the temple, women having the Melchizedek priesthood, they could be authorized to use it in that way. But again, that's not self-assumed. For men, it isn't either. That has to be conferred by the authority of the leadership of the church. These are ordinances that are temporal in the sense that they occur within the temporal church. And that would require a change of policy. But the implication, women would not have to be ordained to specific office since they already have the Melchizedek priesthood once they are endowed. But that is simply an implication, and that was not what I was arguing for. My argument mainly was to help women and men understand that an endowed woman is a priestess. And that, in and of itself, that recognition is transforming, in my view. And that's why I wrote the article, and that's the main emphasis I hope to see out of it. Thank you for your time.
Nine years ago, I presented my first paper at a Sunstone symposium. It was entitled, The Missing Rib, The Forgotten Place of Queens and Priestesses in the Establishment of Zion. In it, I declared my belief that women received the priesthood through the endowment. Since then, there has been much discussion and research on the topic. I am thrilled today that we are at a place where we can move beyond simply asking whether women should hold the priesthood to asking if Mormon women have had the priesthood since 1843, why aren't they using it? In order to answer this question, I must first address two other questions which this first one presupposes. What is priesthood, and in what sense do women have it? The current view promulgated in the church about the nature of priesthood is based on Bruce McConkie's definition from Mormon doctrine that priesthood is the power and authority of God delegated to man on earth to act in all things for the salvation of men. While this is not a bad definition as far as it goes, I think that it has been narrowly used in the church to the detriment of both men and women. First of all, there is the problem of what is meant by delegation. In response to those of us who have argued that the endowment confers priesthood, Boyd Packer in the last general conference reasserted the idea that ordination, that is, quote, ordination to an office in the priesthood, is the way and the only way it has been or is now conferred, end of quote. I see several problems with Brother Packer's statement. First, he fails to deal with the historical development and use of the priesthood in this dispensation. The priesthood was at first undifferentiated into all of its offices. Moreover, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery were not ordained to offices by the heavenly messengers. They simply had the priesthood conferred upon them. The offices are appendages to the priesthood. Brother Packer also fails to deal with all of the historical and scriptural texts which talk about the transmittal of priesthood. Strangely, he quotes from Doctrine and Covenants 1:24, which says that without the temple, there is no place that the Lord can come to restore the fullness of the priesthood. And then he ignores the implication of the text and says that the regular laying on of hands is the only way priesthood is conferred. He also ignores that scriptural texts as Alma 13, which does not talk about priesthood ordination as a laying on of hands, but describes it as a ritual which prefigures the redemption through Christ. And I think that it is in the temple, not in the laying on of hands, that the tokens of the Lord's crucifixion are given to us, as symbols that the purpose of the priesthood is to connect us with Christ and help us follow in his path. Brother Packer quotes the fifth article of faith as an argument against temple priesthood and as proof of how priesthood must be conferred. A man must be called of God by prophecy and by the laying on of hands by those who are in authority. But the temple can also be seen as reinforcing this pattern. Every woman and man who has been endowed in the temple has had hands laid on their heads, anointing them to become priestesses and priests. And the anointings are performed by those who have the authority to do so within the priesthood structure of the church. Temple priesthood is not a free-floating authority, as Packer claims. Since it is tied to an ordinance in the control of church leaders, it very much follows the requirements stated in the Article of Faith. However, it should also be noted that the Article of Faith states that in addition to the laying on of hands by one who has authority, there must also be a calling from God through prophecy. The usual assumption in the church is that this also comes through church leaders, but the statement itself does not say this. Also, such scriptural texts as the Book of Mormon emphasize the importance of an unmediated calling from God for priesthood authorization. The Book of Mormon talks about a holy calling which comes directly from God and a holy anointing which comes by ordination into a priestly community. We often forget in the church that the priesthood has two aspects, what the 121st section calls the rights and the powers. The rights, which are the legal authority to act within the scope of the church, are given by ordination, church offices, and callings. But the power of the priesthood comes only from God. It is connected with faith, divine power, and spiritual gifts. The power of the priesthood is free-floating, in the sense that it is not in the control of church leaders or any other human being or institution. It is connected with the Holy Spirit, which the gospel writer tells us is like the wind, because it blows where it wants, not where we want it to go. The essence of priesthood is the power of God, which the Doctrine and Covenant defines as a literal substance. It is the glory of God, which is equated with light, truth, and love. Section 88 says that this light proceeds from the presence of God to fill all space with the life of God that quickens all things. This is the priesthood. It is the power by which all things are governed, not by rules and threats, but with the authority of truth and love. DNC 121 says the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with these powers given only from heaven. I believe that the rights and power of the priesthood are meant as a check and balance system to prevent the abuse of both ecclesiastical and charismatic authority, to promote the spiritual equality of every member, to include the voice and vote of each member in the governance of the church, and to balance all of our needs for both order and freedom, structure and life. I also believe that these two aspects of the priesthood are extremely out of balance in the church today, because we ask only if a person is properly ordained, but not whether a person is filled with the Spirit and power of God. The priesthood is out of balance in the church because we emphasize corporate management, order, correlation, and hierarchy, while forgetting the spiritual nature of the priesthood and how it is related to the gospel, which is given to transform each of us into the image of God and to bring us into a loving community of saints. The priesthood is out of balance because we have used it to set up a system of inequality which creates barriers between men and women, members and leaders, general authorities and local leaders, and the people and their God. The priesthood has become a stratified system which divides on the basis of gender, race, class, wealth, and position. We all need to repent and recenter the church on the foundation of Christ's gospel of love and equality. I believe that one way to begin correcting this terrible situation is to acknowledge the priesthood of women and to include them in the councils of the church. In order to do this, we do not have to abandon Mormon tradition, nor do we need new revelation, although more is always good, because there is plenty of evidence in Mormon texts to demonstrate the fact that women have both the rights and the power of the priesthood. The rights have been conferred through the temple, and the power has been given by God, as is evident in the lives of the faithful women of all dispensations, from Sarah, the princess of peace, to Huldah, the prophetess, Eliza R. Snow, the high priestess, and Chieko Okasaki, the healer. This brings us back to our main question. If women have the priesthood through the temple endowment, why aren't they using it? It must first be acknowledged that many women are using their priesthood in private and quiet ways. Women are giving blessings and using other spiritual gifts, such as revelation, without asking permission from church leaders. Sister missionaries are preaching the gospel as ministers of salvation. Women temple workers are performing ordinances and passing on priesthood authority. Relief Society presidencies are exercising their keys in behalf of their sisters. And women all over the church are using the power of God to bless their own lives and the lives of others too. But much of this is being done without a conscious realization on the part of women that they are exercising priesthood. And whatever is not named lacks the force and authority of that which is clearly defined and consciously used. Not only that, but women's self-esteem is damaged because they think that men have a greater right than they do to receive and use the power of God. Many Mormon women are not using their priesthood because they don't know they have it. And consequently, many women are failing to develop their own spirituality because they think they need a man and priesthood holder to intercede between them and God. And the whole church is suffering because the power and spirituality of women are being restricted to narrow categories and confined to small groups. Women's voices and concerns are not being heard because they have no say in the governance of the church. While women do not need and should not ask permission from male leaders to use their priesthood in private ways or accepted venues, it is impossible for them to use it in visible ways or in official capacities without an acknowledgement of women's right to priesthood. But is there evidence that women have the right to offices? Although there is no historical evidence of women being ordained to church offices, there are statements which equate Relief Society offices with priesthood offices, making the Relief Society a parallel organization to the priesthood quorums. While I believe that women need their own autonomous organization and publications, I also believe that they cannot be equal or viewed in the context of church, valued in the context of church government until they are part of the larger, comprehensive body of the priesthood and are included in the highest councils of the church. Separate but equal is never really equal because gradations are usually created on the basis of differences. Nor does separation promote understanding and interconnectedness among different groups. I believe that women have the right to church offices and priesthood positions by virtue of their endowments. Joseph Smith said that all priesthood is Melchizedek, but there are different portions or degrees of it. The priesthood bestowed in the temple is the same priesthood given by the laying on of hands, but it is a fullness of that authority and embraces all other authorities, appendages, and offices. It is true that women cannot be ordained to offices in the church without official acknowledgement of their priesthood or acceptance of their authority by the president of the high priesthood. Nevertheless, an important beginning is seeing how the fullness of the priesthood given in the temple carries with it the inherent if to perform ordinances and constitute offices. Why aren't Mormon women using the priesthood? Because they are being prevented from doing so by the current policy, which many assume to be the will of God without examining the historical evidence or theological assumptions behind this policy. But many other women are saying that even if the present policy were changed, they would not want to participate in the priesthood structure of the church. Two major reasons are being given for this response, both of which are compelling to me. First, many women feel they do not want to have a priesthood that is derived from and defined by men. They do not want simply to be incorporated into a male system, which would then co-opt their energies and talents and subordinate female concerns and desires to the service of the male structure. This is a very legitimate concern. How can women function in the priesthood system without losing their autonomy and authority? I do not have a complete answer to this question. I am struggling with it, just as all feminists are struggling with comparable questions dealing with women's relationships to all patriarchs. But I do know this. Women cannot simply be incorporated gradually into the male system. They must have immediate access to the highest councils of the church if there is ever to be any equality. I also believe that there must be a major transformation of the entire Mormon priesthood structure, and that women must have an important and equal role in redefining and restructuring it. We must rethink the meaning and essence of priesthood. We must reconnect the priesthood with the gospel. We must revive the spiritual dimension of priesthood, and we must move away from outmoded models of control and hierarchy toward the establishment of shared power and priesthood community. This brings us to the second reason why many women do not use or want to use the priesthood, and I believe that many men feel the same way. They do not want to be part of an abusive hierarchical system. The question is this: is it possible to participate in the priesthood system of the church without advancing the abuses that are being done in the name of the priesthood? Let me say first that I think much good has and is being done with the priesthood. Many are using it to serve and love others. However, the problem is deeper than simply a misuse of power. The problem is systemic. The very structure of the priesthood is setting up abusive power relationships and promoting false concepts of priesthood authority, which encourage the misuse of power even by very good people. Just briefly, here are some of the worst problems that I see. The priesthood is used to set up a stratified system of power based on gender, race, class, and wealth. Male general authorities are on the top, and women and children are on the bottom. Spiritual and temporal inequality is fostered, while many groups remain invisible and voiceless. Sharp divisions have been created between members and leaders. Leaders do not have to be accountable to members. They can keep secrets about church finances, history, and procedures, while members are expected to reveal their personal sins and finances. When disputes arise between leaders and members, the leaders are believed over members, and members have no recourse and little choice of getting an impartial or fair hearing. Members cannot question leaders, and if they do so in public, they risk being labeled as apostates. The spiritual gifts of members are not valued on an equal footing with those of leaders. There is an emphasis on ecclesiastical office rather than spirituality, truth, and love. Church office is seen as competence, and deference is given to office rather than to truth. Leaders can contradict the gospel or act against the teachings of Jesus without accountability. Priesthood is seen as the right to command, and leaders expect obedience simply because they said so. Whatever the leader says is correct by definition. The checks and balances on the abuses of power have been overlooked. Common consent has been reduced to a loyalty test, and the appeal process is a sham. The show of respect for church authorities. In the last general conference, Russell Nelson talked about proper priesthood protocol and the sacred nature of titles. How is it that we have come to a place where titles are more sacred than the individual members of the church. I said yesterday in the Mormon Alliance session that I am in a state of mourning. My mourning is not so much for the personal... My mourning is not so much for the personal loss I face with the threat of possible church discipline. Though I prize my membership, I am not afraid of losing my salvation. Though I prize my membership, I am not afraid of losing my salvation because I know that that rests in the hands of Jesus Christ himself, not with any church leader. What I mourn is the loss of all the good people who have left the church because of these abuses. What I mourn is the loss of my religion. I have loved Mormon theology and scriptural text. I have loved the temple and believe the priesthood is an eternal principle. But I have seen all of these things. I have seen all of these things used in damaging ways to control people's lives. Instead of being an instrument for spiritual empowerment to lead each individual to God, the priesthood is used to compel obedience to an earthly power system which privileges some people above others. I believe that the principle has become the chief idol of the modern church I believe that the priesthood has become the chief idol of the modern church because it is the object we are asked to give allegiance to above God himself. If the temple, the scriptures, the priesthood, or any other gift from God is seen as more holy than God or the individual members in whom the Spirit of God dwells, then they are idols which must be kept torn down, rent like the veil of the temple. The priesthood, the temple, the church must be taken down stone by stone and rebuilt again on the sure foundation of Jesus Christ and his love, which calls for the spiritual equality of all members, whether rich or poor, black or white, male or female. Thank you.
I really appreciate Margaret's comments, and I hope that I won't depart too far from the spirit of them. I also want to thank Signature Books, the staff and board, for giving us this opportunity to have a voice in Mormon studies with this book. It was an opportunity I waited for and worked for 12 years, and I'm very grateful for it. In 1978, when I received my mission call, I knew nothing about 19th century Mormon women giving blessings, anointing with oil, exercising the priesthood in various ways, but I knew that I wanted priesthood. Going on a mission seemed like the closest thing to a priestly calling that I could find. I sensed or believed that as a missionary I would be almost like an elder. When I went through the Salt Lake Temple in 1978 and received my endowment, I knew nothing about 19th century Mormon belief that women received priesthood via the temple endowment. But I did experience something that I had not anticipated. I experienced a sense that I had the priesthood. This was very real to me. And throughout my mission, I felt that I had the same priesthood and authority of God that the elders whom I was serving with had. My sense was that the elders were allowed to use their priesthood fully, but that I was only allowed to use a tiny portion of it. This was more than a constant frustration for 18 months. This was damaging to my soul and to my growth. I learned very quickly on my mission that as a woman, I was not allowed to fully participate in my church, nor allowed to fully serve God. When I returned home, I taught experimental programs at the Missionary Training Center for a couple of years, and then I ceased all participation in the church organization. I have not participated in the church organization, nor supported it, nor endorsed it for these past 12 years. Nor do I expect to ever reinvolve myself in the church organization again. The purpose of my essay in the book, Sister Missionaries and Authority, was to illustrate that sister missionaries have far more authority and power of God than is generally realized. In fact, that elders and sisters have very nearly the same power and authority, including priesthood, but that sisters are prevented from fully exercising that authority, from fully experiencing and exercising their calling of missionary. I evaluated the authority of sister missionaries by looking at the various components or aspects of the missionary calling and comparing the similarities between men and women. First, I noticed the scriptural injunction or call to serve. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, acting in the authority which I have given you, and baptizing in the name of the Father and the Son. As many as shall come before my servants, embracing this calling, shall be ordained and sent forth to preach the gospel. The Doctrine and Covenants is clear that those who are sent forth to preach the gospel must be ordained. Again, I say to you that it shall not be given to anyone to go forth to preach my gospel or to build up my church, except he be ordained by someone who has authority. Sisters and elder missionaries are called to preach the gospel full time. They are called of God by prophecy and by the laying on of hands by those who are in authority. Because the scriptures are addressed to generic man, woman is implied, and thus these directives to missionaries apply to women as well as men. I looked at the second aspect of the missionary calling, which is the letter that comes from the church, the missionary call letter. This comes from the first presidency of the church and is signed. It is sent to elders and sisters as the official call and assignment of mission. It reads the same for elders and sisters. You are hereby called to be a missionary of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But the language of the letter has changed over the years. At first, sisters were called as a helpmeet to the elders or to render assistance to priesthood in proclamation of the Holy Ghost. Basically, the crucial difference in language is that men are called to represent the Lord as a minister of the restored gospel, and women are called to represent the Lord in proclaiming the restored gospel. Third, I looked at the practice of setting a missionary apart. This is simply a blessing or a laying on of hands by which a missionary is set apart to the calling. It is the laying on of hands by those who are in authority to confer a church calling or position. The setting apart is identical for sisters and elders. In the 19th century church, the word ordain was often used in place of the term set apart. Women were ordained to officiate in the temple, administer blessings, and to take church positions. The next thing that I looked at was the endowment. Participation in the temple endowment is required for all elders and sisters prior to missionary service. But this begs the question, why is the endowment necessary for all missionaries? Several LDS scholars, including the ones here on the panel today, have established that the temple endowment is intended to bring men and women into the holy order of the Melchizedek priesthood. This endowment conveys both the same ordinances to men and to women. A church calling that requires the temple endowment would seem to be predicated on priesthood power. Sisters are set apart to the office of missionary and then endowed in the temple, which is one way that women's priesthood comes close to being activated in the LDS Church. Next, I looked at the licensing of missionaries, the missionary certificate. Basically, the certificate is differentiated for men. They are told that they are certified as ministers of the gospel, and women are certified as missionaries. And through this language difference, this is one of the few of two differences between elders and sisters. Elders are certified as ministers, and sisters are certified as missionaries. The other obvious difference is that elders are ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood, to the office of elder, which sisters are not. But in view of the research of Mike Quinn, Linda Newell, Margaret Toscano, and others, the ordination to office of elder is redundant, since both elders and sisters pass through the temple and receive the endowment. So I view that ordination as a redundancy for the missionary calling. I think it's also important to note that in view of 19th century Mormon women's exercise and use of priesthood, though they gradually lost that opportunity, no official revelation has ever been given revoking women's priesthood. It has simply faded from view. To me, it seems that the language conveyed on the certification, as well as the additional ordination to elder for men, seems to be clearly intended to limit sisters' authority in the mission rather than to enhance the authority and the religious standing of missionaries in general. In light of these five components of the missionary calling, as well as the precedents in church history for women's participation in all five aspects, I've asked myself, are sisters ministers or priestesses? I believe that in God's eyes, they are both. But in the eyes of the contemporary church organization, they are neither. This conflict presents a problem that confronts every sister who enters the mission field. Some, besides myself, including Becky Johns at Weber State and Claudia Bushman in Exponent 2, have speculated that if Mormon women officially begin to exercise priesthood, it's most likely to occur first among sister missionaries, which is one place in the church where women's authority is actually moving forward, even today. Here, the changes in the progress in women's authority are informal changes. They're not formal policies. What's happening is that there are less attempts to stop progress than in the past, and there is a growing flexibility towards sisters' authority in the mission. However, ultimately, I believe that neither the history nor the formal processes of priesthood conveyance are what is most important. As I say in both my introduction to the book and in my essay on sister missionaries, and also as Margaret has said so beautifully today, the priesthood is simply the power of God. I agree with Margaret that it is, contrary to what Elder Packer has said, a free-floating authority. Greg Prince and many others have pointed out, as Margaret also did, that Joseph Smith's drive for obtaining the first priesthood ordinances and ordinations came from the example of Alma in the Book of Mormon, who got his power directly from God through the form of the Spirit of the Lord upon him, not through angelic visitors nor laying on of hands. Joseph searched for higher and higher priesthoods, which I see as simply more light and truth from God, progressing from grace to grace. Call it priesthood, call it grace. It seems the same to me. Obtaining the power of God or priesthood, as I see it, is not merely an ordinance or a church ritual, but rather the personal struggle toward godliness and godhood. Priesthood ordinations, ordinances, and rituals are only outward forms intended to remind us, assist us, or point the way to the true source of priesthood power, the power of God and our relationship to that. Even the church itself is an outward form, a reminder to us to develop our relationship with God. Instead, the church and the priesthood have become the objects of worship. For many leaders and members, the church itself has become their religion by replacing that personal relationship with God. I see Joseph Smith's move away from the spirituality, the simplicity, and the immediacy of the message of the first vision to his organizing of the church and formalizing priesthood authority as actually moving away from God, not forward toward God. To me, it doesn't matter how Joseph got or gave priesthood ordination. All that mattered to me is that God answered his prayers and communicated with him, revealing to him his potential, and therefore setting an example for us to follow. That a human being can know God and that we can learn from God, this was the powerful, simple message of the first vision. I believe that this is what we need to receive the power of God and to move forward with it. This relationship is the essential message of Mormonism. Unfortunately, this message has been buried in under 160 years of strife, materialism, power struggles, bureaucracy, organization, incorporation, management, control, guilt, business, etc., etc. In other words, the church has overburdened and interfered with the relationship between the self and God. That Joseph Smith saw God should tell each of us that we have the same opportunity. If a 14-year-old boy can commune with the divine and channel light and truth, there is no reason why you or I cannot do the same. I guess I have come to see the church as a 19th century schoolmaster, trying to keep us all in the same place, in the same room. This reminds me of how my grandmother used to teach all 12 grades in one schoolroom at the same time. She always told me it was miserable, and I would tend to agree. I personally believe that in order for women to begin to use the power of God, which they can receive, which all of us can receive in any number of ways, through the laying on of hands, such as priesthood ordination and the gift of the Holy Ghost, through the temple endowment, through prayer, that in order to begin to use this, I believe that women need to heal individually on a personal basis and to bond with our own higher self. I believe that women must undo the invisible cords that bind us and begin to reverse all disempowering patterns in our lives, to unlearn all of our thought patterns that tell us that we cannot receive our highest potential, and we need to eliminate all limitations that separate us from our own power. We limit ourselves. God does not limit us. Priesthood is simply the manifestation of my relationship to God, who represents also my higher self and the potential me. God has promised us the same thing that he promised Joseph Smith. If any of you lack wisdom, let him or her ask of God, who giveth to all liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given. On a practical level, I believe that this means that women may need to withdraw from systems that are dominated by men and reinvest their social energies into systems that are headed by women. I recognize that female systems do not escape the pitfalls and sins of male systems. But in a female system, women have a greater chance of healing, exercising their individual authority, and progressing than they do within a male system. I'd like to close with a couple of paragraphs from one of many excommunicated Mormon prophetesses. These are heretical paragraphs, and anyone who's afraid might want to plug their ears. But I feel very much in sync with what this woman, Annalise Guerin, had to say to the church in 1952 and 1954, 40 years ago. The outpouring of the Spirit of the Lord is beginning to cover the earth, even as the waters cover the sea. It is dynamic in scope and results. It is being poured out upon all flesh. Their sons and their daughters will prophesy, but their elders and their rulers will at first condemn them for it and will do all manner of evil to silence them. Even with this outpouring, many are walking in darkness at noonday, and their hearts and minds are remaining completely sealed against light and truth. There are those who are sealed by the traditions of the fathers that were good enough for father, grandfather, uncles, aunts, and generations of ancestors. These are not good enough for the coming generation of light. These old-time religions are as outmoded as the ancient caravan and as lacking in vitality and efficiency as the covered wagons of the pioneers compared with modern transportation. The old things have filled their places well, but new things must come. To cling to the old things which were good enough for our ancestors is to hold ourselves back into their era of time. Without our making their progress or accomplishing the great things that they achieved, we would not only be standing still to pursue such a vain course, we would be going backward. These ideas of holding on to the past, its dogmas, its empty rituals, bring forth a dead, lifeless, unprogressive generation living in the utter ruins of past glories, walking only in the hollow, empty footsteps of the great has-been. The churches were established to help point the way to the higher life, but they have lost this perspective and no longer point the way, but claim they are the way. Some even assume that they are the entire goal and purpose of existence, the celestial authority of heaven itself. At present, they are blocking the way with their empty forms, powerless priesthoods, orthodox creeds of non-expansion and uninspired dogmatism, and unbelievable usurpation of the rites of heaven. It is time to go beyond the earthly churches, beyond the empty phrases, the dead forms, into the holy of holy in man's and woman's own soul, and contact God through individual effort. Each must begin to do his or her own praying, his or her own searching, own asking, and most of all, learn to open up his or her own heart and mind to the great outpouring of heavenly divine light that is beginning to enfold the earth with increasing vibrations of everlasting glory. Every church that is not leading its members into those greater powers promised by the Son of God is blocking the road of progress. Such churches permit none to attain to a point beyond the organized mass of their orthodox conformity. Such churches have so completely sealed the doors of progress to their members that they have become instruments of damnation. They deny the power of God and the gift of the Holy Ghost, even while claiming that they alone possess the authority to bestow such a divine gift. Such claim loudly that they alone on earth possess the authority to bestow the Holy Ghost by the laying on of hands, and at the same time they deny that those upon whom they bestow such divine power have any ability to use the gift and the powers that it contains. Thus, they deny the power of God and the power of the Holy Ghost to fulfill its own purpose. And last, prayers will be answered and desires fulfilled when it is possible to ask without doubting in one's own heart. They are fulfilled when one literally becomes the attitude that fulfills the law. When you can get the feeling that you actually possess the gifts that you require, without doubting, they will be yours completely and fully. It is the feeling or the attitude, not the thinking, which brings the fulfillment. It is the power of holding to an attitude until one becomes that attitude, which fulfills it. Seek not to know God through churches or men or leaders, but seek God through your own heart and through your own divine attitude. Fulfill the holy promises. Perfect those holy attitudes, and you will be dissolved, and you will become that which you interpret and seek. Seek to become love in its compassion, divine forgiving, and Christ-like mercy, and you will know the mysteries of godliness and the great mystery and power of becoming godly. Thank you. We have about 15 minutes left for question and answer, although we may be able to extend a little over because we've got a two-hour lunch break coming up. We would like those of you who have questions to approach the microphone. The radio station who's recording this session expressed that they would like questions to approach the microphone. But we'll start with Cindy, and I'll just repeat your question.
As someone who has been a sister missionary and who has exercised and continues to exercise her priesthood, I would like to say something to all of the panelists, especially Margaret. All they can do is rip up a 5x7 piece of paper. They don't burn us anymore. They cannot silence you. If anything should change in your status as a member of the church, it does not change you. It does not change your message. It does not change how anyone who understands and appreciates your efforts will feel or respond to you. We love you. We look to you for guidance and hope that nothing will ever change except that they have the power to rip up a small piece of paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
I, too, would like to thank this panel for the wonderful work that you've done and for all of your comments, and especially yours, Margaret. I've thought for the last couple of years that it's a real, rather delicious irony that what Joseph Smith sought when he went into the grove was wisdom. Wisdom, as I'm sure many of you know, is as a feminine personification of deity in many ancient writings. And I think that we are at the point where we desperately today need wisdom, if we want to personify it as our Heavenly Mother, or as Mormons would personify the feminine aspect of deity. And I hope that that is something that we will all seek.
Thank you.
It strikes me that Margaret Toscano and Maxine Hanks may be a sort of combined Anne Hutchinson of Mormonism. And I make this analogy deliberately because I think the historical analogy is appropriate here, in that I think most religions, if not all religions, have sooner or later consolidated into hierarchical structures. And it seems to me the message that we've been hearing is that hierarchy simply doesn't creates calcification. And the solution is to have the priesthood that we have in our hearts. Now, Luther, of course, also preached that and realized very quickly where this would lead. So it seems to me there's a sort of conundrum here. If indeed, as we've heard, we do have the priesthood in our hearts, why do we need a church? And if that is the case, then what is the problem?
Is this on?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. I hope that it was clear from my presentation that I'm not against structure. And I think maybe Maxine and I differ a little in this. I believe that there has to be a balance between the akshars and the inner spiritual power. I think that there are important things that come to a community and to individuals with both of these concepts about priesthood power. And in fact, I see as one of the great strengths of Mormonism the way in which it has tried, at least theologically, is the way in which it has tried to combine a lot of things that are found in other religions. That it takes structures that you see like in Catholicism and other religions that are more organized, and I think tries to marry it with some of the spiritual powers and charisma that are found in Protestantism. It hasn't been altogether successful in doing this on a practical level, but I think that we still have, in our scriptural text and in other places, some strong notions that give us a way of balancing this. One of the reasons why I feel like that it's important to balance the what I sometimes call the outer and the inner aspects of priesthood is that, as I said in my paper, I think that these act as a check and a balance against the abuse of any kind of authority. Charismatic authority can be misused. I mean, I don't want to be in a church where only those with charismatic authority have a vote or a say in the structure. I think that when you ordain every member in the church to priesthood, where you have an outward ordinance that ordains people and then includes them in the community, that is a way of bringing a form of democracy into an organization. And so I think that the outward things can be quite important. Another way in which outward offices or outward structures of priesthood can be important is that there's been the tendency in Western thought to often denigrate body and matter and the outward form of thing. By having an organization where you honor the embodiment as well as the spiritual or the transcendent, I think, again, this promotes a very healthy balance in a religious sense. Historically, women have often been connected with the earth and body and sort of things that were viewed as lower. So I don't want to belong to a religion that denigrates matter or embodiment. And so I see Mormonism as having a very strong theology that combines all sorts of important ideas of how we bring together the outer and the inner aspects of priesthood.
And I want to add something quickly to that, since the comment was addressed to both of us, that I too believe in systems and organizations that can aid individuals in achieving their personal goals. And that's why I mentioned that I myself have disassociated and from systems that are male systems and have reinvested my effort into systems that are I consider to be female run or female systems that express a female perspective. I just think that that's a healthier, more progressive approach for women to grow toward their potential than to participate in a system that is headed by men. And that includes a lot of what's around us. So it's very difficult to find systems that are female-oriented or express a feminine perspective. Some examples that I would offer would be Exponent 2, the Mormon Women's Forum, and the Counterpoint Conference.
First, let me say that I'm very young and admittedly ignorant on a lot of these issues. And I hope that you'll take my questions, and I have just one short and then one you can elaborate on as my effort to understand your position and not as any kind of a value judgment on the things you said. Am I correct in inferring that you, Ms. Toscano, said that there is no historical evidence, although there is evidence of women giving blessings, that there's not evidence of women ever being ordained to offices in the priesthood, even in Joseph Smith's time?
Yes, actually Michael is much better at all the details of this than I am, but the only evidence that you could bring out is that when the Relief Society was first organized, and maybe Linda you remember these too, you have those, that Relief Society offices were compared to priesthood offices.
Okay.
And also the term ordination was sometimes used when women were set apart for offices. And there was a debate about what that meant. But that's the only evidence that I know of. Well, there is, I think, later also in Utah, do you remember this? That was it where they talked about deaconesses? I'm trying to remember. I'm sure you guys are better than I am.
Sarah Kimball, whose idea it was in the beginning to even have the Relief Society, and who went to Joseph, and he told her that what she was proposing, that he had something better, and that's when he organized the women. And she was secretary in the Relief Society and also was there at the beginning of the Relief Society in all those early minutes. When she came to Utah and became a Relief Society president very soon in Utah Valley, she set her Relief Society up the way Joseph Smith had told them, to pattern it after the priesthood. And so they had deacons and teachers, and the deacons came and set the room up, and the teachers taught the lessons and so forth, and I'm not sure what other offices she had, but it didn't last long. Obviously, but that was her understanding, and it was the understanding that comes out repeatedly in the women's writings and their conversations and so forth that were there in that early Relief Society. And if I may, I'll just read a paragraph here from my essay. When Joseph organized the Nauvoo Relief Society, he gave women an autonomy currently unknown in the church. There's ample evidence that Joseph envisioned the Relief Society as an organization for women parallel to priesthood hierarchy for men. He instructed sisters to elect their own president, who would select her counselors. Then he would, this is a quote from him, ordain them to preside over the society, just as the presidency presides over the church. If any officers are wanted to carry out the designs of the institution, let them be appointed and act apart as deacons, teachers, and etc. are among us. And that is a direct quote from Joseph Smith.
Yeah, my real question centers or is in light of Maxine's comment about when Joseph organized then the priesthood of the church, that he was moving up, that was a move away from the spiritual state he was in with this at the theophany. And my question is to the panel, how do you reconcile personally Joseph's apparent free feelings about the priesthood and women giving blessings and not having a problem with that and all these attitudes about priesthood in the church in the early church, which apparently Joseph was a part of? How do you reconcile that with his when he at the same time was organizing, so let's say, a male-dominated forum of the 12 apostles and things like that? Do you understand my question?
First of all, I'll just quickly say that, you know, we all come from very different places in the book and on the panel, and I'm speaking somewhat from a radical feminist theology. But I'll turn this discussion of the tension that arose in the early church between the immediate charismatic authority and the organizational authority that did develop to others on the panel who I think are better equipped to respond to that.
I don't think there's any question that Joseph Smith created a system that was male-dominated. The priesthood offices were defined very hierarchical sense, and although there was an evolution during his lifetime of the relationships of authority and the various functions that those offices held, Joseph Smith never ordained a woman to any of those offices. His teachings to the women and the men whom he ordained with the endowment, or to whom he gave the endowment, I see as emphasizing what the priesthood revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants emphasized, and that is the priesthood is power, priesthood is not divided, and that any office is simply an appendage to that power, whether that office is the office of a deacon or whether it is the office of an apostle or whether it is the office of church president. that it is simply an appendage. And an appendage can be cut off, and the main structure, the main body, still lives. But the appendage cannot live without the main body. The body doesn't need the appendage to live. And so the priesthood is the greater living force. And Joseph Smith taught that women had equal access to that as a principle of power. In my view, I think, and this is totally an interpretation, but I don't see any statement by Joseph Smith or anyone referring to him, quoting him even years later, where they said he even spoke of the possibility of women being ordained as bishop, stake president, high councilman, having administrative positions. These things were necessary, just as it's necessary to do the dishes. But it's not something that he ever proposed for women. I don't know that he saw this. In fact, his teachings to the Quorum of the Anointed seem to be the very contrary, that he saw this as any kind of denigration of women. But it seems that, in his view, the necessary structure of the church was something that he, for whatever reason, wanted limited to men. But he wanted women to know that they had access to power, and that that power was undifferentiated, and that that power was spiritual, and that that power to which women had equal access was the power that created the worlds, the power that was eternal, and the power that was beyond hierarchy.
Michael, I've wanted to ask you a question for a long time. Do you think the Holy Order was in any sense a priesthood quorum?
Oh, the Holy Order was unquestionably a priesthood quorum. In fact, they called it the first quorum of the church. And the first quorum of the church included women and men on equal standing. It did not include some of the counselors to the first presidency for a period of time. It did not include Sidney Rigdon, who was first counselor. And so there were women of the church.
Do you think it had governing power?
Initially, no. Initially, it was simply for the purpose of administering the endowment, and then for Joseph Smith to instruct those who had received the endowment to understand what the endowment meant. But eventually, it did have administrative powers, both spiritual and secular. We could call them secular, but they were theocratic. Joseph Smith taught that when a new revelation was to be given, the first quorum, involving both women and men on an equal footing, was the quorum to which that revelation would be given first for approval. And then it would be submitted to all lesser quorums, beginning with the Quorum of the Twelve.
Important.
Then there was a joining of the first quorum, or the Quorum of the Anointed, in which women had equal access with men, in many of the theocratic developments that occurred in the last few months of Joseph Smith's life. And I can't take the time to get into that, except to say that the Quorum of the Anointed was involved as the first quorum of discussion for a number of the, even before the Council of 50, curiously enough, and even before the Council of the Twelve, curiously enough, in a number of the preparations for Joseph Smith's candidacy for the presidency of the United States. And these were not consistent, because there was a lot of things going on where Joseph Smith would turn to one group, then he would turn to another. So it wasn't consistently that the Quorum of the Anointed was the first quorum of discussion for these theocratic developments, but it sometimes happened. And so the role of the Quorum of the Twelve is expanding. Quorum of the Anointed was expanding. Where that would have gone beyond June 1844 is anyone's guess. But it was in the process of expanding at the time Joseph Smith died.
I'd like to also add to this discussion. Anyone who reads the early Relief Society meetings, early Relief Society minutes, it's just very clear that the Relief Society was a parallel organization for women, not an auxiliary to the men. It was many years before it was it developed into what we now know as an auxiliary. And again, if I could just refer to what Joseph Smith said to the women. He said that the society should move according to the ancient priesthood. He was going to make of the society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. That's a direct quote from Eliza Snow's minutes. And then Newell K. Whitney, when he attended Relief Society a few weeks later, in the company of Joseph Smith, told the women, "In the beginning, God created man, male and female, and bestowed upon man certain blessings peculiar to a man of God, of which women partook, so that without the female, all things cannot be restored to the earth. It takes to restore the priesthood."
I'd like to add one thing to Linda's comment. In the book, I quote Eliza R. Snow from the Women's Exponent, where she clearly lays out in, I think it's 1882, that the proper channels of authority for women in the church were through the Relief Society leaders, not the priesthood leaders. That women would go to the Relief Society presidents and on up to the top, rather than go through priesthood channels. That would be a major shift in today's church. We'll take about 4 more minutes, and we'll stop at 1 o'clock if anyone else has a couple more questions.
Here they are over here,
Maxie. Yes. Go ahead, sorry.
Just a couple of comments. First of all, I want to thank you for your thirst for knowledge and truth. I feel that you have spent many hours upon your knees, as I have and many of the women that are sitting here in this audience today. I want to tell you that when you power of the priesthood, the divine Malka priesthood is the name of the feminine priesthood and was given to women from the very beginning of creation. But we've had to wait wisely time. It has already been conferred upon us, and we act in it as we are creators. Keys are being restored to us at this time because of the time that it is. I thank you for your thirst for knowledge, as all of us have, for you've touched my heart very, very much this day. And I commend you, and I'm so grateful to be part of this body, beautiful spirit that is here with us today. I honor you.
Thank you very much. One more question or comment? No? Oh, everyone. Okay, we'll take 2 more. Does that make it easier?
I hope you'll pardon my question. It's more of a personal nature. I'm interested in the difference of avenues that Margaret, you have taken, and Maxine, you have taken. I've grown up in the church, and I've become a part of an institution that's taught me to value freedom and equality and these things, and I feel a strong sense of intensity with those theologies, and I'm having a hard time trying to find out which direction I can go, because I feel so strongly tied to the core knowledge that I've been taught since a young child, and a direction that may not be a part of that institution that seems to be going in an opposite direction. I feel like if I stay in it, I may become stagnant in my growth. If I go out of it, I may miss an opportunity to develop in a way that the church can give me. And I don't know, maybe you could just comment on that just a little bit.
I'll respond real quickly and then see what Margaret has to say. That's why my balance is a little different than Margaret's. The balance that I choose to strike is balancing my own relationship with God and my movement toward that with systems and organizations that, as I said before, support and empower that search. I choose to avoid organizations such as the church and other male-dominated organizations that do not empower but, in fact, rob me of my ability to proceed. So that's how I balance it.
I feel very sympathetic towards your concerns. I guess that I've tried to walk a fine line between holding on to my Mormon heritage and theology, which is very dear to me, and at the same time expanding out and trying to break away from systems that I think are abusive. my stake president is telling me that this that I've got to quit walking this line in between. I don't want to quit walking the line in between. I guess that I want to have a foot in both worlds, as it were, and I hope that I'll be able to do that. There is a lot of good in Mormonism, and I want to stay in that and embrace that, but I think it is spiritually damaging if you only stay within this tradition and don't look outside and are not enriched by that. And so I guess that my approach has been to range out as far as I would like in terms of my thoughts and other things. I guess I'm like my sister, who says that she's daring in the realms of the mind and try to be more traditional in other senses. And so far, it's been okay. I hope that it continues to be.
I also want to thank you guys very much for the depth of your research and the depth of your feeling that you've put into thinking about these things. I wanted to take a chance to respond to what Mike said about the one-third of us who are male here. I want to give three explanations for the fact that we're here. First of all, we feel welcome. I think that in general in academics there's, and in much of society, there's a tendency to try to exclude the oppressor from the discussions among the oppressed. And I've never felt that here. I was privileged for unknown reasons, because nobody else had done the research yet, to respond to Linda Wilcox's first Mother in Heaven paper. I can't explain that. There's no good explanation, in fact, but I appreciate it very much. That our voices have not been excluded. Also, these people are my sisters. And I feel that both personally, in terms of my own personal sister and her leaving the church, but all the women here. And I feel treated like a brother. And finally, Nelson Mandela said, you know, until we're all free, I'm not free. And I really feel that deeply in myself. When I hear Margaret talk in her liberating terminology about our theology, I am freed. And I think we can all do that for each other. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comments and for your participation. And I want to mention one thing very quickly. This panel was originally rejected for the program, and it was only through the lobbying of one of the panelists that this panel was placed on the program. There were other papers and panels proposed for this year's symposium that were also rejected, and one of the reasons given was that there were too many feminist programs and sessions on the agenda. This is why I strongly urge women to invest their energies, their time, and their money into systems that express a female discourse and feminist perspective. And I invite all men to come and help us with our subjects. We would love to work with you. Thank you.